Hi friends, welcome back to another episode of Stuck in Arrakis. I was taking a shower right before I sat down to record, and I realized that I, like, never introduce myself anymore. Because I assume that all of you guys just know who I am already, which is not the case. I'm getting new listeners every day. So, if you're new here, and this is the first episode you've ever listened to, thank you for joining me. My name is Leslie. I'm a 32-year-old book nerd weirdo that sits alone in a room and talks to herself sometimes. And today, the 32-year-old weirdo is talking about The Light Fantastic, book 2 in the Discworld series by Terry Pratchett. I've been having tons of fun reading this with you guys, even though we're only on the second book. I enjoyed the second book a lot more than the first, and I have tons of reasons why, of course. So let's just jump into it. So The Light Fantastic, as you guys know, is the second book in the Discworld series, and we're with Rentwind and Two Flower again. And the last book that we finished, book 1, ended in a literal cliffhanger, but as I'm sure you all can guess, everyone is actually fine, and the spell in Rentwind's head saves the day. And just as a little bit of a quick summary, once they are saved by the spell, we learn that Great Atun, I don't know, how do I say that? How do I usually say that? How do you guys say that? I'm just going to say the world turtle for now. But please tell me how you usually pronounce the world turtle's name. So anyway, the world turtle has basically finally arrived at her destination. And there's this like big red star in the night sky, and it's coming closer to them all the time. And the wizards at the Unseen University realize that something is happening, something is coming, and they need to find Rentwind, who has the 8th spell, so they can use the Octavo, or the Octavo, however you say it. I usually say Octavo. But so they can use the Octavo to, I don't know, save the world from whatever this red star is. So the narrative kind of bounces back and forth between Rentwind and Two Flower going on an adventure again, and all of the wizards of the Unseen University trying to locate Rentwind. And then we also have these moments where the spell in Rentwind's head communicates with him, and then eventually the outside world. And then, as you can probably guess, eventually Rentwind says all of the spells and saves the day, which actually he really doesn't save the day. This is really interesting because last time we talked quite a bit about the speculation behind where the world turtle is going. Is she just kind of swimming in space? Does she have a destination in mind and things like that? And we learn the answer in this book. Let's talk about that in a minute. So I want to talk about that in a little bit more depth whenever we get to that part of the podcast. But it was really exciting and interesting to see, and I'm excited that we got more information about the turtle. So I want to start with just taking a look at what happens during the escape. So like I said last time, Rentwind and Two Flower were basically hanging off the world. They had acquired some sort of space shuttle, and they were falling off the edge of the world. But they're saved from falling forever by Rentwind's spell, which also plays an enormous role in the rest of the plot of the book. Which is great, because I was really interested to learn more about the spell during the last book, whenever we still didn't know what it even did. And actually, it wasn't even Rentwind's spell that saves the day, per se. It's actually that just the fact that that spell is currently living in Rentwind's head. Because apparently the Octavo realized that the 8th spell was about to leave the disc because he was falling off. So it, like, cast its own change spell to take Rentwind and company from the edge of the disc and put them back down safely in a mossy forest full of talking trees, which is what actual heaven probably looks like. At least according to me. The elder wizards from the Unseen University witnessed this event. They witnessed the change spell, embiggening, getting bigger and spreading from the Octavo. And then they summon Death to ask what the fuck just happened. And Death tells them that it was a change spell, and that the 8th spell was about to leave the disc, I'm pretty sure. And I think he knows that. But also, they interrupted him while he was at a party. Then Death also tells him that the 8 spells, or the 9 spells? Is it 8 or 9? God, now I can't remember. Anyway, all the spells from the Octavo have to be said together by next Hogwatch night, which is in only like 2 months, or the disc will be destroyed because the star is coming towards them. Or really, they're heading towards the star. And that seems really ominous when you're at the beginning of the book and you're like, oh shit, they're going to crash into the star. The star's going to crash into them or something like that. But it turns out that around the star are actually the world turtle's eggs. And so whenever the 8 spells are said, those 8 little baby turtles hatch. And then now we have like 8 little other disc worlds with, you know, their little turtles and their little elephants too, which is just so precious. I actually don't remember that from the first time I read this book, so that's why we're going through it again, because I don't remember shit most of the time. Speaking of the Octavo, which I'm sure everyone will make fun of me for mispronouncing, but that's just, you know, whenever you read a word a certain way and you never hear it pronounced, I have a hard time changing the way I pronounce things even afterwards, you know what I mean? Even when I know how they're supposed to be pronounced. Last time I got some shit for the way that I say grimmery. I know that's not how you actually say it, but funny enough, actually, the first time I ever encountered that word, I believe, was in World of Warcraft when I was like a senior in high school. And I know that all of the characters probably pronounce, or like the NPCs probably pronounced it the correct way, but maybe I never paid attention or something. I don't know. I used to play a lot of World of Warcraft. That was really the point of that story. I'm opening my book because I had not done that before I started recording, and now I'm about to have to read something. So, anyway, let me entertain you with my constant gibbering. I'm looking for page 185. Okay. All right. So about the Octavo, we learn that the spells in the Octavo could actually foresee this whole Red Star business. And it's probably because they've already been on this journey to what the 8th spell calls the beach of the universe. They were probably there when the Great Turtle laid her eggs in the first place and knew that she was eventually going to come back or something. I have no idea. So knowing this information, they themselves, the spells who are sentient and capable of forethought, arranged for one of the spells to take up residence in Renswin's head because he's always running away and he is always very good at escaping and not being found and giving people the slip. And they don't want to be reunited to save the disc. They don't want to be said for some reason or another. So they're trying to keep Renswin away from the Octavo. Also, the spell seems to be leaking knowledge into the world using Renswin's mouth, I guess. So that's how we find out that the world turtle has climbed onto the beach of the universe. Because Renswin says it. It comes out of his mouth. He doesn't even realize he says it. And then he says something else, too. There's going to be a lot of me searching because I'm using my Kindle for this, which is not my favorite, but take what you get and you don't throw a fit. All right, let's see. Oh, yeah, okay. So Renswin also corrects someone that the star is not going to bring death. It's going to bring life. And we find out later that the reason it's said to be bringing life is because there are 8 little baby turtles around it, which is so precious and cute, and I love it so much. We also finally get to see the spell work for once. We did get to see the change spell at the beginning, but we had never gotten to see Renswin's actual spell work. I can't remember. Hold on. Oh, yeah. He's fighting with the Red Star people, you know, the cult of people who think wizards need to be eradicated and that will please the star and then the star won't kill them or something like that. but it says, I'm just going to read this whole passage because I love it, A, and B, This is the first time we've seen Rincewind use magic, and the first time Rincewind, I think, has ever used magic and felt what it's like to use magic, which is hilarious. Okay, it says, the spell stirred in his mind. He felt it trickle into his brain like iced water and brace itself. A cold tingle coursed down his arm. His arm lifted of its own volition, and he felt his own mouth opening and shutting, and his own tongue moving as a voice that wasn't his, a voice that sounded old and dry, said syllables that puffed into the air like steam clouds. Octarine fire flashed from under his fingernails. It wrapped itself around the horrified man until he was lost in a cold, spitting cloud that rose above the street, hung there for a long moment, and then exploded into nothingness. Wow, that's fucking cool. I feel like all of the other wizards at the Unseen University spend so much time putting all these spells into their heads, only to use it once, and then it just disappears. So whenever I thought about seeing the first spell in this book, that's not what I had in mind. I wasn't thinking of something cool. That's not true. That's definitely not the first spell I've seen. But it's a very different magic than the other spells that I've seen in this book and in the series so far. I mentioned a second ago the Red Star people. I think that's what they're called, but I can't really remember. But while all of this business with the Red Star is going on, this group of people called the Red Star people or something similar forms, and then they start making demands. And the demands are, as I mentioned, I think that all wizards have to leave the disc or something like that. The crowds outside the gates were generally making one of two demands. They were demanding that either the wizard should stop messing about and get rid of the star, or, and this was the demand favored by the star people, that they should cease all magic and commit suicide in good order, thus ridding the disc of the curse of magic and warding off the terrible threat in the sky. I think this is a pretty good example of the idea that common people or people who aren't using, you know, their most logical brains will try to find meaning in anything in the world and kind of cling to it. I don't think there's any evidence that they have that the wizards are at all responsible for the Red Star, or that them killing themselves would do anything to stop the Red Star. But it's like they just need a fall guy or a kick dog or something like that, so they pick the wizards. When everything is said and done and Rincewind has said the spells and saved the world, the Octavo is eaten by the luggage and goes wherever the luggage's food goes and is probably finally getting some goddamn peace and quiet. I think it's smart. I don't think the Octavo just happened to fall and get eaten by the luggage. I think that, like the whole plot with Rincewind, it knew what it was doing, and it knew that if it disappeared and nobody could find it again, that nobody would fuck with it. You know what I mean? So I feel that. I can sympathize with that feeling and empathize with it, because most of the time I just want to hide and do, you know, not be bothered, have some goddamn peace and quiet. Once the spell is finally out of Rincewind's head, which is part of the whole ceremony with him saying the 8 spells, is that he also makes the spell leave his mind and go back into the Octavo. He thinks to himself, maybe he'll re-enroll at the university and give that whole wizarding thing another chance, because maybe he could be good at it. I think that we've already discovered via multiple different viewpoints that Rincewind doesn't have any sort of aptitude for wizardry. So I don't know if trying again is really going to do anything for him. But I know that we do have a couple more Rincewind books, or quite a few, actually. So who knows? Maybe he does learn some magic and actually do something. And Two Flower, at the end of this book, goes back home, leaving the luggage with Rincewind, which is also very cute and sweet. I feel like, so let's just go off topic here and talk about Two Flower's character for just a second, because in the first book, I feel like he was very open, and he had a very open mind, and he was just kind of experiencing the other side of the world and all it had to offer without judgment. But in this book, I feel like he was pretty judgmental of some things, like calling things quaint and ethnic and things like that, and trying to buy everything and kind of trying to stick his nose into other people's business. I just feel like Two Flower was way more of an annoying tourist in this book than he was in the first one. And I don't know if I like that change, to be honest with you, because I kind of loved the naive, non-judgmental Two Flower. And I don't really appreciate this new Two Flower in this book, who's kind of trying to frame other people's lives according to his ideas of the world or something like that. Like, and I mean, it gets him into a lot of trouble in this book too, so maybe he had to be annoying so that he could get in trouble or something. But I feel like Two Flower could fall his way into trouble, you know, even though he was looking at the path that he's walking on. So I don't think that those moments were really necessary for his character, and I don't know, I liked book one Two Flower a lot more. But I really did enjoy the ending of this book. I thought it was very sweet. I thought it wrapped up very nicely. Everything was just kind of, I don't know. The thing that I'm loving most about reading the series, especially this year, is because for a while there, the whole escaping into Wheel of Time and their problems are so much bigger than mine. And whenever I'm reading this, you know, I don't have to worry about what's going on in my own life. That kind of got old. Not that Wheel of Time got old or anything like that, but it kind of stopped working for me recently. And I'm finding that a lot of my solace comes from things that make me laugh and things that are funny and these kind of trivial problems that the characters in Discworld have are a lot more healing for me right now than Wheel of Time is. So I'm really enjoying reading through Discworld for that reason, and because obviously I love Terry Pratchett and I love the series that I've read so far. But it's also just really helping me kind of stay out of a funk that I've been kind of naturally trying to fall into now that it's getting really dark really early outside and it's cold and shit like that. Moving on from the Octavo, I want to talk about the representation of magic that we get in this book compared to the last one. Because we get to see way, 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 way more of how the magic system works and magical feats in general. We see a lot of the elder wizards at the Unseen University cast magic, and we kind of see what actual good magic looks like in the world instead of just seeing Rincewind struggle to do anything. Of course, we know that one of the major plot points in this book is that the Red Star is coming. The Wizards of the Unseen University know that the creator spells need to be recited in order to save the disc from that big red star. So they are very actively and aggressively searching for Rincewind throughout the entire book. So we kind of get to see them actually doing things and coming together for a common cause and things like that, using different rites and rituals and spells and shit. During the change spell scene in the beginning of the book, one of the changes that happens is that the librarian is turned into an orangutan, and that's in the very first chapter of the book, and it's one of my favorite things of the series. I love the librarian. I don't really understand why the librarian being a monkey was part of the change spell, unless the librarian has always, you know, in the back of his mind, really wanted to be an orangutan. I don't actually know why that happened to him, but I love it so much. I love it so much because I would love to be an orangutan librarian. Like, that would be awesome. Ooh, actually, now that I'm thinking about it, that kind of sounds like a good idea for a Discworld tattoo, is getting the librarian. I might do that. Anyway, he seems very happy to now be a monkey, and he's still able to do his librarian duties, and he's very cute, and I just love it so much. So, for some reason, I remember that being in the first book last time, so I was kind of looking for it, and then somebody told me it's in the second book, and then I was really excited to see it happen, and now we have the librarian as an orangutan, and I'm so excited about it. Another cool element of magic that we see in this book is the wandering shops. So there are these shops that sell all sorts of little things that exist in some other dimension and just kind of appear randomly on the disc. Two Flower gets his luggage from one, and then he and Rincewind find themselves in another one in this book. And so they just, I mean, the shops just wander forever. They have to find an empty space that they can occupy whenever they want to go somewhere. And they open up their shop and people can come in and buy stuff and then leave. I really like this element of the series a lot. I also thought it was really cool that the shopkeep, who was such a curmudgeon, I loved his character. But I thought it was really cool that he moved his shop to Ankh-Morpork again so that they could easily travel to where they needed to go so that Rincewind could get to the Unseen University. I thought that was a really cool way to get them from A to B. And I think it's also really cool to learn that those kind of shops not only exist to sell junk, which is kind of what the shop we see in this book does, but you could also get like some good shit there, like how Two Flower got the luggage. So I'm hoping those show up again in future books. I forgot the word future somehow. One of the things that I noticed about this book is that the structure is just a lot better and a lot different than book one, mainly because this book actually makes narrative sense rather than just feeling like three separate stories that have gotten smashed together. Like, we see Two Flower and Rincewind get from point A to point B, and you understand how they got there, and it's not just like the transition is like, there they are. Surprise, we're here in this next story now. And I also really enjoyed that in addition to following Two Flower and Rincewind, which was our main POV for the last book, we're also seeing a new newer POVs where we're getting the perspective of the wizards at the Unseen University. And I like that switching back and forth narrative structure a lot. I think that it's an effective way to kind of have a bunch of different narrative plot lines going on at once. Obviously, I read multi-POV fantasy series, so that's something that I'm used to reading and that I enjoy and that I understand. But I do understand how that might be a little bit jarring for someone else. But I think that it's done pretty well in this book. Even though this is the second book in the series, we do still learn quite a lot about the world. So I just wanted to take a little bit of time to talk about some of the stuff that I learned about Discworld in this book. So when we start the book, we already learned that in 2 months, the Great Turtle is going to get to her destination. So right off the bat, we already know that she's close, and we learned in the last book that most people are really, no one is really sure, you know, if the World Turtle has a destination or what she thinks or what she does or anything like that. But that's not for lack of trying. So Rincewind is telling Two Flower about some of the measures that wizardry has taken in order to figure out more about the World Turtle. And Rincewind tells Two Flower, quote, "There's a bunch of wizards that have been reading it." Oh, hold on. So backtrack. Okay, so basically, Rincewind tells Two Flower that there are a bunch of scientists who have been wizards who have been trying to read the World Turtle's mind for years. And apparently, they hadn't realized how slow the turtle's thoughts were going to be. So apparently, there's a bunch of wizards that have been reading it in shifts for 30 years. All they found out is that Great Etouine is looking forward to something. And now we know that the something that she is looking forward to is her baby's hatching, I guess. And when we get there, that's exactly what happens. Her 8 little babies hatch thanks to Rincewind reciting all of the spells. And then now, I guess we just have 8 little turtle babies on the journey back to wherever we're going with us. I'm not sure if they're going to stay with us the whole time or anything like that, but that would be cool. After this happens and the 8 babies hatch, the world turtle is obviously very pleased and contented. And apparently that spreads throughout all of Discworld. And the, in fact, most people on the disc were currently in a state of mind normally achievable only by a lifetime of dedicated meditation or about 30 seconds of illegal herbage. It's the herbage for me, please. Thank you. Another really cool element of this book is that we actually get to go into the realm of death. And as you guys know, Death is one of my favorite characters. We really haven't been able to talk about him a lot yet, but in a couple of books, we'll finally get our first Death POV, and we're all gonna love it a whole lot, I promise. I'm gonna make it a whole love letter to Death and how much I love him, but for now, you just have to trust me that he gets a lot better than just being, like, stereotypical Death. So, basically what happens with the Realm of Death is, and I want to talk about the druid plotline a little bit more in depth later when we get to the shit that made me laugh section, because I think that that whole part is so funny. But basically, Twoflower manages to offend some druids, and I don't remember exactly what happened here, but they, like, send his mind into the Realm of Death, or him into the Realm of Death, or something like that. And he becomes weightless, and then Rincewind can't wake him up. So Rincewind gets a magic potion from some old horse crone. And the potion sends him into Death's realm so that he can rescue Twoflower. And I really like this section a lot because Hades and Death are some of my favorite elements of mythology. I really like this kind of idea of the underworld being a sort of realm where souls go and live forever. Not really in a, like, you're going to hell and you're going to suffer for the rest of eternity type of way, but just, like, an afterlife of sorts. This is just one type of afterlife. And I really love Hades a lot. So I was excited to go into this sort of realm of death and see what, you know, just what death is like. There are a couple of really funny bits that I want to read to you guys after Rincewind gets into the realm of the dead, because I just love Rincewind and I think this is hilarious. So, basically, Rincewind drinks a potion and then he kind of floats up and he can see himself and things like that. And he goes into the realm of death and he has this little blue line connecting his, like, spirit to his body. And Rincewind understands that, and this is a quote, "If the little blue line snapped, he'd have to spend the rest of his existence hanging around Ouija boards and pretending to be people's dead aunties and all the other things lost souls do to pass the time." I love that. The idea that dead souls just pretend to be aunties. And the sounds. So in addition to having this little blue line, you know, this realm has a very realm of death look to it. It's all swirly and black and foggy and, you know, mysterious and things like that. So that's the look of it. But the sounds, I think, are the most interesting because I just want to read this straight from the book. "The land ahead of him sloped down sharply and a dry wind whispered across the frost-cracked rocks." It really did whisper. As Grey Eddies caught at his robe and tugged at his hair, Rincewind thought he could hear voices faint and far off saying things like, "Are you sure those were mushrooms in the stew? I feel a bit..." And, "There's a lovely view if you lean over this..." And, "Don't fuss, it's only a scratch." And, "Watch where you're pointing that bow, you nearly..." And so on. So I'm guessing that those are people's last words, which is hilarious. Also, Death has a cute little house there. Yeah. "There was a garden up there with orchards and flower beds and a quite small black cottage. A little path led up to it." I think it's so precious that Death has a cute little house with a garden. All of the flowers in his garden are black, but, you know, he still has a garden. I think that's pretty typical Death shit. Oh yeah, also the luggage is also there because the Realm of Death is a place it can go to follow its master. So the luggage has followed his master into the realm of death, which is convenient because Rincewind and the luggage are a great pair. They do a lot of their greatest rescue work together. Rincewind also meets Death's daughter, Isabel, who he found when she was just a little girl and I guess rescued her. And that's one of the reasons why I love Death so much, because he has such a big heart. But we'll get to there when we get to there. When Rincewind finds Two Flower, he's not, you know, in the River of Souls or, you know, being tortured or anything like that. He's actually teaching Death and the Four Horsemen of the Apocalypse how to play a card game, which Death then becomes obsessed with mastering. And I realized when I was writing the notes, this is the second time I've read this book, and it wasn't until I was writing my notes, looking over the book a third time, that I realized that they're playing bridge. I can't remember exactly. Two Flower says that it's the same word as damn or something like that, like something that goes over a river, and I can't believe that I didn't get that until the third time I was looking through the book. Now I want to talk about a couple of characters. So one of the characters that we meet in this book is Trimon, and he's the real villain of the piece. He is ambitious, he wants to be the top dog at the university, which apparently is pretty common for wizards. They all kind of want to be the top dog and gain more and more power, and apparently there's a whole situation where sometimes they kill each other in order to gain that power, so I guess it's not really all that surprising that one of them is ambitiously evil. But he's ambitious, and he's evil, and he just really sucks, and he's very corporate. He's a very much a spreadsheet and agenda type of villain. But I guess that his whole thing is he thinks that he can use or read and learn all of the spells in the Octavo without any problems. So he steals it, and he tries, and it opens up, like, this horrible wormhole in his head, and all sorts of horrible things take up residence there. So whenever Rincewind finally confronts him, he's already, like, a bunch of monsters. But eventually there's a showdown between them, and Rincewind wins, and he saves the whole disc, and Two Flower gets to land the killing blow, which is all very exciting. I really like that scene a lot. Trimon was a real dick, and he made everybody really nervous and feel, like, really weird. I don't know. My other favorite character that we meet in this book, well, actually, Trimon's not my favorite character at all, so let me restart. My favorite new character in this book is Coen the Barbarian. And Coen the Barbarian is another hero, of course, and I absolutely adore him. He is not your typical hero. He's old as fuck, he's missing teeth, but he's still kicking ass, and he's still getting the ladies, too. My favorite thing about Coen, other than the fact that he's totally badass and saves the day even though he's old as fuck, is that Two Flower notices that he's missing teeth and introduces him to the concept of dentures, which Two Flower also has. He also has dentures. So Coen has a set of, like, diamond dentures made for himself, which is amazing. What a sugar daddy. He's got this hot-ass young wife now, and a mouthful of fucking diamonds. While I was reading the book, I wrote a note in the book that says, Two Flower is like Prometheus, but instead of fire, it's dentures and insurance. I was probably pretty high whenever I wrote that. Okay, now I just want to talk about general things that I really loved or that made me laugh. There are quite a few of these, and I'm really excited to talk about them. The first thing that made me laugh was actually the first line of the book, which says, "The sun rose slowly, as if it wasn't sure it was worth all the effort," which I feel every day. There's also a little bit more description about the world, like there always is, or there always has been right at the beginning of the books. And it's talking about kind of the topography, I guess, of the disc, and it says, "Down below the mines and sea ooze and fake fossil bones put there by a creator with nothing better to do then upset archaeologists and give them silly ideas. We also get a little bit of information about some of the spell books, I guess, in the world. And it's talking about the Octavo, but the passage says, "There are, of course, many famous books of magic. Some may talk of the Necrotelecomnicon, with its pages made of an ancient lizard skin. Some may point to the Book of Going Forth around 11-ish, written by a mysterious and rather lazy Lamaic sect. Some may recall that the Bumperfun Grimoire reputedly contains the one original joke left in the universe." I want to read that. I mentioned in the last episode how Terry Pratchett takes a lot of classic fantasy tropes and turns them on their heads in a very amusing way. An example of that is that apparently the wizards are all chain smokers. They smoke cigarettes like chimneys. So instead of being these very, severe, academic, pristine type of creature, or, people who are so dedicated to their higher purpose of knowledge, these wizards just smoke like chimneys, and they're incredibly competitive and are constantly trying to kill each other to gain rank, which is very different from all of the wizards that I've ever read in a normal, like, fantasy book. You know what I mean? So I always enjoy stuff like that from Terry Pratchett. I mentioned earlier that the change spell takes Rincewind and Two Flower from the edge of the disc into a mossy forest with talking trees, and you guys all know how much I love talking trees. I think Loyal is basically a talking tree, and that's why I like him. But the narration says, "Of the tree, if it was very good indeed, it would eventually be reincarnated as 5,000 rolls of lavatory paper." I kind of alluded to this earlier a little bit, but in this book especially, for someone who has such an enormous willing suspicion of disbelief, Two Flower can be a really tough crowd. I mentioned earlier that in this book he seems to be a little bit more judgmental, and at one point he claims that this small creature that lives in a fucking mushroom isn't a gnome just because he doesn't have on a little red hat. Like, I just feel like Two Flower, I don't know, Ankh Morpork is so stupid and shitty, you know, it's like so dirty and full of assholes, but Two Flower is just floored by all of it, no matter how disgusting it smelled or looked or anything like that. And now in this book, he's just so, I don't know, it just feels like nothing's living up to his expectations, which just seems like such a weird shift. He also learns that elves on the disc aren't like the elegant, magical creatures that he grew up reading about, but they're actually really nasty and steal your teeth and nails trimmings and shit like that. That was a little bit of a culture shock for him. There's a passage in this book that I really hit close to home for me this year. And that is, Rincewind is thinking about how his life used to be like completely different and totally boring. So he says, he supposed there were some people somewhere who had some control over their lives. They got up in the mornings and went to bed at night in the reasonable certainty of not falling over the edge of the world or being attacked by lunatics or waking up on a rock with ideas above its station. He dimly remembered leading a life like that once. And that's how I kind of feel this year. Somewhere there are people who wake up every morning in a place where it's safe to pop into the store to pick something up or spend the holidays with their family. And I remember that being my life once, and it's so different now that I really can't reconcile both of them. You know what I mean? Like, I just feel like that's why this year has been such a like fever dream for me, because it just feels so different than everything I've ever known. Not being able to go anywhere or do anything. I know that I'm preaching to the choir here, but yeah, I thought that was interesting to see my current thoughts reflected so well in a book that was written 30 years ago or so, way before coronavirus. One of my favorite plot lines in this book is the druid plot line, especially the druid that's flying the rock. And on this world, Druids use very archaic tech to understand how the world works. For example, this druid, hold on, let me read this passage. I gotta find it first. Is this 67? Go away. Okay. So according to the druids, the universe, they said, depended for its operation on the balance of four forces, which they identified as charm, persuasion, uncertainty, and bloody-mindedness. Thus, it was that the sun and the moon orbited the disk because they were persuaded not to fall down, but didn't actually fly away because of uncertainty. Charm allowed trees to grow, and bloody-mindedness kept them up, and so on. So when Rincewind and Twoflower wake up and find themselves on a flying rock, and they talk to the druid and are like, hey, how the fuck is this rock flying right now? He says, look, don't worry. If you keep thinking the rock shouldn't be flying, it might hear you and become persuaded, and you will turn out to be right, okay? It's obvious you aren't up to date with modern thinking. So it seems, said Rincewind weakly. He was trying not to think about rocks on the ground. He was trying to think about rocks swooping like swallows, bounding across landscapes in the sheer joy of levity, zooming skyward, and he was horribly aware he wasn't very good at it. Oh god, that's so funny. So why is this druid flying a rock? Well, he's flying the rock, which he calls computer hardware, to some circle the druids use to tell what time of year it is. So it's a big circle of rocks acting as a computer that's acting as a calendar, and those rocks are computer hardware, according to the druid. And the best part of this plot line is Rincewind explaining culture shock to Twoflower after Twoflower offers to give this druid an almanac with all of the info that they're using the rocks for. And this, oh, this is so funny. Hold on. I'm just going to read it, of course, because what? What? I don't understand. Oh, here we go. Okay. So Rincewind says, have you ever heard of culture shock? What's that? It's what happens when people spend 500 years trying to get a stone circle to work properly, and then someone comes up with a little book with a page for every day and little chatty bits saying things like, now is a good time to plant broad beans, or early to rise, early to bed makes a man healthy, wealthy, and dead. And do you know what the most important thing to remember about culture shock is? And then Twoflower says, what? And he says, don't give it to a man flying a 1,000-ton rock. God, that's so funny. Eventually, they land, and Twoflower makes a mistake of calling them ethnic or something like that, and then they send Twoflower into the realm of the dead, because Twoflower is an idiot. Also, as I mentioned earlier, the Unseen University Wizards and eventually Trimon are trying to find Rincewind, so they can get the spells. And Trimon goes to an astrologist or something like that to get Rincewind's horoscope. And I thought this was interesting. So first of all, Rincewind's astronomical. Oh my god. Rincewind's astrological sign is a sign traditionally associated with chessboard makers, sellers of onions, manufacturers of plaster images of small religious significance, and people allergic to pewter, but is not a wizard sign at all. And the horoscope for today, I guess, or, you know, that day, is, it reads as follows. Today is a good day for making new friends. A good deed may have unforeseen consequences. Don't upset any druids. You will soon be going on a very strange journey. Your lucky food is small cucumbers. People pointing knives at you are probably up to no good. P.S. We really mean it about the druids. So this horoscope is trying to warn Rincewind. How would he even know his horoscope for the day? Rincewind doesn't read horoscopes. That's hilarious. And it's too late, of course. Another trope that we see turn on its head in this book is the monk figure. Back where Twoflower is from in the Adjutian Empire, priests are much like they are in our world. They do good things, they collect alms for the poor, stuff like that. But on Ankh-Morpork, or on this side of the world, priests are very different. Tuvalar says, at home, they go around with begging bowls. It's their only possession. And then Rincewind said, this would be for putting the blood in, right? And Tuvalar says, blood? And he says, yeah, from sacrifices. And then whenever Tuvalar says, no, it's for, like, money. They've dedicated themselves to life of poverty and good works and God and stuff like that. And Rincewind goes, well, they don't sound very holy to me. I guess that's similar to how Tuvalar refuses to believe that gnomes can't be gnomes unless they have red hats on, or elves are these whimsical, cute, small creatures that definitely don't steal your teeth and nail clippings. Before we move on from religious figures, though, the druids, whenever Rincewind and Tuvalar get there with, you know, the rock or whatever, they're trying to figure out why their circle isn't working. So they're going to sacrifice a young virgin or something like that. And the conversation that Rincewind and Tuvalar have about the situation is fucking hilarious. Rincewind says, but they're going to sacrifice her, if you must know. Tuvalar says, what, kill her? Yes. Why? Don't ask me, to make the crops grow or the moon rise or something. Or maybe they're just really keen on killing people. That's religion for you. Oh, that's so funny. There's a passage about, I mean, you've probably noticed at this point that there hasn't been any mention of witches or female wizards at the Unseen University. And this is actually explained in one passage that I want to read. Unseen University had never admitted women, muttering something about problems with the plumbing, but the real reason was an unspoken dread that if women were allowed to mess around with magic, they would probably be embarrassingly good at it. Which is interesting. I kind of wish that it wasn't like that, because I would like to see some witches at the Unseen University, but I do think that it's very possible. I have read one of the witches' books, I think, and I think that we're going to find that witches are, or female magic users, are really a lot more powerful than male magic users, and I think that will probably unfold in some bigger and more meaningful way at some point in the future. Whenever Rincewind goes to save Tuvalar from the land of the undead, Tuvalar gets his camera out, of course, because he's a tourist. And Rincewind has this hilarious thought. It says, Rincewind had a fleeting vision of Tuvalar handing around his pictures and saying things like, this is me being tormented by a million demons, and this is me with that funny couple we met on the freezing slopes of the underworld. Oh, God, I love them. I also really loved the troll plotline in this book. I think the druid plotline was probably my favorite, and then the troll plotline was probably a second. But, oh, it's just so funny. I love the trolls in this book so much. So basically, in this series, trolls are rocks who can also have, like, humanoid forms. In some way. I think it has to be night, and then it takes them a minute to turn from a rock into a humanoid, but they can do it. I think not all rocks are trolls, but all trolls are rocks, obviously. And a lot of the bigger rocks and the mountain ranges on the disc are actually trolls who will cause some real problems if they ever decide to finally wake up and move around. Like a whole mountain range could move because it's all one troll or something like that. The trolls know who Rincewind is because of a legend that they know. I guess because they're all old as fuck. Hold on. Yeah. The legend is, when the red star lights the sky, Rincewind the wizard will come looking for onions. Do not bite him. It is very important that you help him stay alive. So I don't know why do not bite him was part of the legend. Or the instructions that they got, because I don't know if they bite anybody else. Maybe they do. But I thought that was cute. One of the trolls tells us that trolls are known to suffer from philosophy, which is hilarious. And it happens to them when they sit down one evening and think, why bother? And then they just don't bother ever again. And they stop to think about things, and they all just kind of get stuck thinking about those things. And that's why some of them never move. This is my favorite passage in the entire book. We're still talking about the trolls. and how some of them just kind of sit down and get stuck and never move again because they're thinking about stuff. And the troll says, "The one on the end's my aunt. I don't know what she's thinking about, but she hasn't moved for 200 years. Rincewind says, "Gosh, I'm sorry." And the troll says, "Oh, it's no problem with us around to look after them. Not many humans around here, you see. I know it's not your fault, but you don't seem to be able to spot the difference between a thinking troll and an ordinary rock. My great uncle was quarried, you know." Rincewind said, "That's terrible." And the troll says, "Yes, one minute he was a troll, the next he was an ornamental fireplace." Oh, God, that's so funny. That's my favorite line in the entire book. I laughed so hard when I read that. Eventually, the trolls help Rincewind after they discover that Twoflower and Bethan have been taken and kidnapped and, you know, etc. The last thing that made me laugh, I mean, not really the last thing, but the last thing that made me laugh that I want to talk about is, let me look here. Harina is some, like, sellsword mercenary that Trimon has hired to help him find Rincewind. So she's been hunting for him. And she has a partner named Weems, who is terrified of the luggage. And Rincewind basically tells him that the luggage is going to keep following him, and he's never going to stop following him. And the whole time, and it says to, like, freak him out, you know what I mean? And make him, like, really paranoid and nervous. Nothing happened for the rest of the day, but to Rincewind's satisfaction and Weems's mounting paranoia, the luggage showed itself several times. Here it would be perched incongruously on a crag. There it would be half hidden in a ditch with moss growing over it. And yes, the luggage does eventually eat Weems, which is very satisfying for everyone. And that's it. That's my entire discussion of The Light Fantastic. I really like this book. I thought it was funny. It helped pull me out of this kind of 2020 funk that I'm in, that I feel like I'm never going to get out of. And I really enjoyed reading it. It made me laugh pretty hard. And can't remember off the top of my head what the next book is. I think it's Weird Sisters. Let me look though. Equal Rights is the next one. Who is that? Oh, Discworld's first female wizard. Okay, all right. So yeah, we're going to get a little bit more magic and a little bit of female wizard and maybe some gender role type of stuff and things like that. So I'm really excited to move on to the next book. Thank you guys so much for listening. Find me on Discord. My links are in the description. I have a Patreon if you want to support what I do. Yeah, that's it. I hope you guys all have a happy new year and that you're staying happy and healthy.